We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, another great find from Instagram, Kwana J. Hicks. I found myself enchanted by his readings of classic poetry. So we'll do the interview of Kwana J. Hicks. He can be found on Instagram at Poems of Yore, Y-O-R-E. And then I find out he's also an extremely talented musician and author. So I'll feature some of his music and him reading a chapter from his book, Saturn's Window. So we start with the poem Frankfurt Brook by Violet Jacob, then the interview, then him reading Because I Could Not Stop for Death by Emily Dickinson, then Ozymandias by Percy Shelley, Kwana's song called As Further Gets Closer, then the poem Children of Light by Robert Lowell, then the poem The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, Kwana's tune All My Life featuring Angie Hart, then a chapter from his book Saturn's Window, and wrap it up with his tune called Dear Love. Stay tuned, Mystic Pete Chronicles!
Frankfurt Brook. The willows stand by Frankfurt Brook, from Frankfurt up to Heath. Sun on their cloudy silver heads and shadow underneath, they ripple to the silent airs that stir the lazy day, now whitened by their passing hands, now turned again to gray. The slim marsh thistle's purple plume droops tasseled on the stem. The golden hawkweeds pierce like flame the grass that harbors them. Long drowning tresses of the weeds trail where the stream is slow. The vapored mauves of water mint melt in the pools below. Serenely soft September sheds on earth her slumberous look. The heartbreak of an anguished world throbs not by Frankfurt Brook. All peace is here, beyond our range, yet neath the selfsame sky. The boys that knew these fields of home by Flemish willows lie. They waited in the sunshot flow, they loitered in the shade, who trod the heavy road of death, jesting and unafraid. Peace. What of peace? This glimpse of peace lies at the heart of pain. For respite, ere the spirit's load, we stoop to lift again. O load of grief, of faith, of wrath, of patient, quenchless will, till God shall ease us of your weight, we'll bear you higher still. O ghosts that walk by Frankfurt Brook, 'tis more than peace you give. For you, who knew so well to die, shall teach us how to live. By Violet Jacob. Read by Kwana J. Hicks.
It's March 1st, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Kwana J. Hicks. And I ran into you on, of all things, well, there's this, apparently this internet thing happening, and there's some application called Instagram, and I saw your wonderful post. So the internet is not pure evil. There are good things that happen. People meet each other and make connections, and I'm so happy to know you and to see what creative output you have. You have Poems of Yore, P-O-E-M-S, of Y-O-R-E on Instagram. Let me allow you to introduce yourself and explain what you're doing.
Yeah, so, you know, I guess if somebody finds me on Instagram and they find poems of yours, they're thinking, this guy is just a poetry lover, and that's just one aspect of what I do. I do a lot of different artistic things. But I guess the poems of yours thing started because February came around and it was Black History Month, and I was like, you know what, let me just post a Maya Angelou poem, and I'll just read that and post it on there. And I initially just posted it as just one thing I was going to do, and then I saw a lot of people liking it and reposting it, sharing it, and messaging me about it, and I was like, all right, let me, I guess I should make some more of these, let's just see what happens. And suddenly there's over a couple thousand followers now, so I figured I might as well keep going with it, you know? But yeah, aside from that, I do a lot of different things, like music, and I'm an author as well, writing fiction, and anything creative, I guess, you know? Lover of the arts.
You are posting poems that you read of classic literature, and you read them beautifully. And it's just makes it very accessible and a lovely way to for people to enjoy poetry. That's what Poems of Yore is.
Sure, you know, and the funny thing about this project is that I guess a lot throughout my life people have told me, like, oh, yeah, you have a really good speaking voice. But I'm hearing it excessively with this project. And it's a little weird because I think I just sound like a regular guy, you know? I don't think there's anything special about how I'm talking. So, but I guess maybe it's different and stands out. I still don't understand what makes my voice stand out over others, if it does at all. But people are always telling me that, and maybe I'm enunciating well, or I'm just not sure what it is. I just, you know, if you hear your own voice all the time, you might not see what's special about it.
You have this beautiful, calm approach, and you say it very well. It's very relaxing. And I found that when I just put your poems on loop and listen to it 5 or 10 times, the deeper meanings start to come to me. Like you have a poem, Ozymandias, and this is by Percy Shelley, famous poem, famous poet. I've read this poem, but it takes a while for it to really sink in. As I say, after about the fifth listening, I'm going, ah, I'm getting it now. And it opens up to me. So I really appreciate the verbal input. I take things in visually, but audially, it goes in even stronger, I think. And then I'll go and like look it up online and see what the scholars say about Ozymandias, and then, oh, some new meanings. So it opens the door for me.
Yeah, I love that poem too. It is pretty powerful, you know. What does he say? Look upon my works, ye mighty, in despair. I love that line. You know, maybe he was a great, powerful person that accomplished all these things, but he's saying, look at it in despair, because, you know, all is lost.
It's talking about these ruins in the desert of this once great king. Actually, Ozymandias is another name for the great Egyptian pharaoh, Ramses. And here it is in ruins.
Right. And it's like, you know, there's no hope. It doesn't matter what he's achieved and how great it was. The emptiness stretches for miles and miles in the desert. It's all gone. And you know, I guess that's open to interpretation in different ways. Maybe, I don't know. How do you take that? Does anything we do matter?
I think often great poetry will reveal things about life, philosophy, human nature. There's the beautiful words. Sometimes that's all there is. But sometimes it's like deep philosophy underneath that it gets you to think.
Makes you think, for sure, yeah.
And you've done works by Robert Frost, Emily Dickinson, my favorite poet, actually, Edgar Allan Poe. We were talking about your reading of William Shakespeare's Sonnet 18. When I listened to it about a dozen times, I finally understood what was happening with. There's a lot more to it than you would think on the surface, comparing thee to a summer's day. We all heard that one, but there's more in that poem.
Yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. Like, and hopefully that's one of the goals that I've realized is that could come out of this. It wasn't the initial goal. The initial goal was just like, let me just post something for Black History Month, you know, show some support. But now I'm seeing, like, as I post these poems, these people have been dead for hundreds of years in some cases. And hopefully, you know, what is very old to some is brand new to many new listeners, and they could appreciate that. You know, imagine Shakespeare back then. He never would have thought, like, hundreds of years later, somebody from New York is, like, reciting his poems and posting on something called Instagram for thousands and thousands of other people to see and listen to. You know, a painting, look at the painting of him and hear what he wrote that long ago. I think it's a good way to keep these dead poets alive, you know?
Well, you mentioned Black History Month, so let's just talk about the racial elements here. I think people may have this idea of, like, particularly classic poetry being kind of a white person's thing. I actually came up through poetry or learning about poetry because I'm a musician and I'm a cellist. And I would go to poetry slams and often bring my cello and play behind poets who were often African American. So I'm improvising wild stuff on the cello while they're, you know, spitting out rhymes. So to me, it was always very culturally diverse. Now you have poets like Maya Angelou and the poet laureate Amanda Gorman, who read at inauguration. She's actually a local Santa Monica woman. So it's not just a white person's thing, but a lot of the classic poets are white. So talk about this.
Yeah, and that's just because of just how history played out. You know, the suppression of people of color was a big thing back then. But it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody that was white was suppressing them. Obviously, that's why things eventually did change, because a lot of the white people thought, like, hey, we need to change this for one reason or another. Maybe some people say it was more political than, I mean, like, not so much about the race and more about some other political things for why the Civil War happened. But regardless, you know, if poetry was just for white people, obviously, you know, you wouldn't see any other Black famous poets out there. Especially now, like, it's come such a long way and evolved, and it's just, you know, something that anybody can do. You don't really need to play an instrument. You don't need to be able to sing. It doesn't even have to fully make sense on the surface. It can be interpreted in many different ways. It's something for everybody. So I guess, you know, initially some people could think it's a very white thing. But the more you look, if you really look deeper into it, it's an everyone thing, you know.
Frankly, yeah, poetry is in every culture and goes way, way back. I mean,
haikus, you know,
like, tremendous amount out of the Middle East, you know, Rumi and all this stuff. And then, but of course, in the 20th century, then you have people like Langston Hughes coming in and really giving the Black community a voice.
Yeah, I was planning on doing some of that stuff too. There's so much on the list. There's a ton of poems I really want to get into, and I'm learning a lot more about poetry too, because there's some poems I just never even, like, heard of it all, and it's fascinating to see how good these writers were, because we have many distractions now with the social networks and video games and just everything that the internet puts in front of you, and the OCD of, I mean, the ADD of that whole situation. It's just hard to pay attention to exactly one thing anymore. But back then, they didn't have all these different distractions. They just had what they had, the basic forms of art, painting, you know, poetry, storytelling. And what else was there to do? So I think maybe that era was breeding, like, some fantastic stuff. You know, not to say that nothing's happening that's fantastic right now, but I'm just really impressed by the things I've been reading as I research what poem to do next for the Poems of Yore project.
I think part of the point I'm trying to make is that people may think of poetry as this kind of antique, precious, elite kind of art form. Often, the poets were radicals, or outsiders, or weirdos, or persecuted. You know, they were the often the underground radicals. And so they would have been us in their time. I've just called us underground radicals. What do you think of that? I mean, sometimes they became part of the court poetry and so forth. But let's also remember that rap is poetry. Music is poetry. But, you know, out of rap, we have some of the most radical and rebellious ideas put forth in the arts.
Yeah. You know, I guess poetry can be looked at as a white person. I understand that perspective. I guess that's if you really are strictly in a white environment and that's it. But if I grew up here in New York, so, you know, Orange County, New York, which is about an hour from Manhattan, and it's pretty culturally diverse. So I've always had like a lot of people around that are doing many different things. You know, some people could even say that skateboarding, it was always like a white thing, but being in New York, it wasn't. It was like an everybody thing, you know, especially growing up. Just, you see a lot of different backgrounds doing a lot of different things here. So I guess maybe if it's like Midwest or something, almost everything seems like a white person thing, right?
Right? We're taking over. No, we already took over. It's your turn now.
No, it's an artistic thing, and everybody can appreciate art, regardless of the culture that you're from and background, ethnic background.
One of the most exciting nights of my life is when I went to Limmer Park. There's a really interesting cultural scene over there. But this was like 20 years ago, and there was this style of rap where, like a face-off, it'd be a rap battle. And I kind of heard about this, but to see it happen live, and like, people fighting and being aggressive and in the moment coming up with original potent attack rhymes with meaning directed at that person right now and the way they look and so forth. It was very exciting. And it's been documented in a few different movies. But wow, that was really great to see.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that sort of thing when I was younger too, and friends doing that sort of thing. Like I said, you know, being in Orange County, New York, we've done a lot of different things. Like I've also just been a skateboarder and a musician, and it's always been pretty diverse, you know. But poetry is sort of a new thing for me to be exploring in this way. I never thought that I'd be reading other people's poems and gaining a following from that, you know. It's just weird, because I do a lot of other different artistic things, and this was never in the plans. It's interesting how things just play out sometimes. But now, as I see the following growing on a daily basis, I'm realizing, like, yeah, this is maybe a good sort of thing to continue to do for several different reasons. A lot of people seem to enjoy it. It's fun. It's nice to do something artistic and be noticed for it. You know, feel like you're being appreciated for what you're doing. Sometimes as a musician, you could work on a song for a month and put all kinds of work into it, and then it gets like no attention at all. And as an artist, what you really want to do is just create something and show the world what you've done. And if most people aren't even acknowledging it, it's a pretty sad feeling. So it's pretty interesting where I was creating this art of poetry, reading other people's poems. The plan wasn't to be like, let me get known from doing this. It was really just like, oh, Black History Month, I'll do a Maya Angelou poem, throw it out there. And then I looked at the Instagram again, and suddenly like a lot of people were commenting and writing me, and it's just weird. I think it's weird. And then I looked deeper into poetry of it's huge on Instagram, apparently. And I didn't know that initially. It's huge in general, I guess, but especially on Instagram over the past few years. I'm not sure what triggered that, you know, but it seems to be the place to post poetry.
I think you are identifying an issue in the arts and with artists. Sometimes we're completely ignored. Sometimes the things we think are brilliant, nobody else gets it. In fact, Emily Dickinson, if I understand, was completely unknown in her day. She had tried to get a couple of things published, but the response was, nah, this is not good. And I believe her sister found her beautifully put together works in her own like hand-bound books and was able to get this before the public. But how close was it to it being completely lost, being thrown away with just random stuff, and we would have never had one of her extraordinary poems. So, yeah, this is what the world wants, what our own muse gives us. This is a challenge for people who hear their own drumbeat.
Yeah, so Emily Dickinson is your favorite poet, huh?
I think so.
I need to read more Emily Dickinson. I've read, you know, a handful that I like. But I don't even know, like, how many poems does she really have? Like, she's a ton, right?
Dozens. And to me, she has both beautiful, original language. And you know, against the argument that this is somehow very precious or elite. Like, the language is just wonderful, wonderful imagery. But ideas. These are insights and philosophies, and so revelatory about subtle things. And this is where poetry really shines. We think, it makes us reconsider and look at things in a new way. And if it can be done with exquisite language, then it really becomes a very high work of art.
Yeah, I love her poem, the one that I did, I could not stop for death. So he kindly stops for me. I love that, the way it's put together. And I think, yeah, I guess I get it. You know, if you hear it read in a certain way, it'll sink in a different way. Because when I just read it, like in my mind, reading the words, you know, it felt a certain way. But I after I recorded it and heard it back, yeah, I even listened to my own version of it a few times and it sunk in more. So I guess that's maybe what people and you are getting out of this, you know, a deeper meaning and hearing it in a certain way. And maybe with how I'm delivering those lines, it helps somehow. I'm not sure if it's because I'm trying to be sincere as I do it. You know, I don't want to sound like theatrical with it. I'm trying, like as I talk to you, I try to read the poems as just a very real delivery of it as opposed to acting.
Makes it very accessible. What were the first poems that appealed to you when you were younger? How did it come to you?
You know, probably through music, mostly, because being a musician and a lover of, you know, great bands, one of my favorite bands was the Smashing Pumpkins. So Billy Corgan was, I loved his lyrics, you know, very extremely poetic stuff. I mean, it's just poetry set to music. And so for me, that's what poetry was from music. I'd never really looked too much into the traditional stuff, except for, like, you know, the exceptions of, like, The Raven, you know, some of Edgar Allan Poe stuff, The Conqueror Worm I really liked. Just not that much. I never really delved into it as much as a poet or a true poet lover, you know? So that might be weird for people that really love the Poems of Yore thing to hear me say, like, I don't really have too deep of a background in poetry. I'm just being honest. I'm more of a musician and a writer of other literary works, not so much poetry.
Do you remember that first poem that was non-musical that you read and it just opened some doorway for you that really hit you?
It was probably The Raven. Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, it's just really clever. I love the way he put certain things together. And as you read that, too, if you really try to understand what's being said, it expands your vocabulary about things that just, like, you know, some of the lines in it, it's like, what does that mean? You're forced, if you really want to understand what he's saying, it's like, what does that even mean? You know, and you look into it, and you suddenly you're learning something about history that you never would have. Like one of the lines where he says, you know, the Knights Plutonian Shore. I guess initially somebody could read that and say, like, what did they know about Plutonian back then, you know? But it has nothing to do with what we're talking about in physics with Plutonian. It has to do with the god, one of the Roman gods, Pluto.
Pluto.
Yeah. And the Knights Plutonian Shore being, like, sort of the layer between the underworld and this realm. And so you just wouldn't know that on the surface unless you look deeper into it. And so if you look at everything else he says, one of the things he says too is, one of my favorite lines from that poem is when he says, is there balm in Gilead? You remember that?
Yeah.
Is there balm in Gilead? And it's like, why did he say that? So if you look into why he said that, and it becomes really clever how Gilead was like a very it was repeated throughout the Old Testament a lot, you know, in the Middle East, and balm was one of the things in that area that was like sort of an ointment or medicine that would cure people. And so he used it as a metaphor to kind of talk about, you know, his relief from the loss of Lenore. You know, is will there be relief from this? Instead of saying that, he's saying, is there balm in Gilead? Thought it was pretty clever. But that's what, you know, poets do. They thinking outside of the box, and they force you to think out of the box to understand and, you know, crack the cipher of what was being said.
Nevermore. You're indicating an important way for people to enter poetry. Well, first, I would suggest people just find poems they like, that they enjoy. Don't feel like you have to be an expert. Just get in, jump in the pool. And like, after I listen to your readings over and over, then I wanna like go and research. So let it come from your natural desires and appreciation. And then when you feel like it, look a little deeper, figure out what a Plutonian shore is or a bomb in Gilead, or, you know, like, there's a lot of scholarship out there, but don't think you have to be some kind of poet wizard right off the bat. Just enjoy, find things you enjoy, and that's the way to access it. And I think when you hear people read it like you are, that's a really easy way in. Quanah J. Hicks, thank you so much for this time together. We're going to be featuring some of your readings in this show, and I can't wait to see your Instagram channel expand and keep growing.
Thanks so much, Pete, for having me. It was really fun to talk to you.
Quanah J. Hicks with Poems of Yore on Instagram. Any other information you want people to know about?
If you just want to research my name, and you know, I'm a writer too, so if you ever want to check out some of the books I've written, they're on Amazon. Just look up my name, Quanah J. Hicks, or actually it's Q.J.Hicks is my author name on there, and you'll find some books. Zova 7 and Saturn's Window, writing a new book this year for the Zova 7 universe. Science fiction, metaphysical, fantasy weirdness, if you're into that.
I'm in the middle of Zova 7 and enjoying every word.
Thank you.
Thanks again for your time.
Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove, he knew no haste, and I had put away my labor and my leisure too for his civility. We passed the school, where children strove at recess in the ring. We passed the fields of gazing grain. We passed the setting sun, or rather, he passed us. The dews drew quivering and chill, for only gossamer, my gown, my tippet, only tulle. We paused before a house that seemed a swelling of the ground. The roof was scarcely visible, the cornice in the ground. Since then 'tis centuries, and yet feels shorter than the day. I first surmised the horses' heads were toward eternity. By Emily Dickinson. Read by Quanah J. Hicks. Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Read by Quanah J. Hicks. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read which yet survive. Stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them, and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Thank you.
the light on. Night can be cold, but don't worry, I won't be gone forever. And it's a long way home, but I'm not afraid, I feel you. It's closer. Down winding roads, I walk through the night till the dark finds morning. On straight through the days, there's a voice in the distance guiding me to you. And it's a long
Children of light. Our fathers wrung their bread from stocks and stones, and fenced their gardens with the red men's bones, embarking from the netherland of Holland, pilgrims unhouseled by Geneva's night. They planted here the serpent seeds of light, and here the pivoting searchlights probe to shock the riotous glass houses built on rock, and candles gutter by an empty altar. And light is where the landless blood of Cain is burning, burning the unburied grain. By Robert Lowell. Read by Quanah J. Hicks. The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Read by Quanah J. Hicks. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my books surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, 'Tis some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, this it is and nothing more.' Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. 'Sir,' said I, Or, madam, truly, your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard you. Here I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing, doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. But the silence was unbroken, and the stillness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this, and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. 'Tis the wind, and nothing more. Open here, I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door, perched upon a bust of palace just above my chamber door, perched and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven, thou, I said, art sure no craven, ghastly, grim, and ancient raven wandering from the nightly shore? Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore. For we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing farther than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow he will leave me, as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken. Doubtless, said I, what it utters is its only stock and store caught from some unhappy master whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore of never, nevermore. But the raven still beguiling all my fancy into smiling, straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore meant in croaking, nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing to the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core. This and more I sat divining with my head at ease, reclining on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er. But whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore. Then, methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer swung by seraphim, whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee respite, respite and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, O quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent or whether tempest tossed thee here ashore, desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore, quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend, I shrieked, upstarting. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door. Take thy beak from out my heart and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. And his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
What should I do to make you understand? Patiently I'll lead you by the hand. Time is only running out for me, and I can only hope that you will see.
All my life I've waited for you. All my life I've waited for you. So please don't let me go.
All I ever wanted is right here, but suddenly you have to disappear to distant places that are nowhere near. I'm speaking out and hoping you will hear.
All my life I've waited for you. 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 So please don't let me go. Please don't let me go. I've waited for you. I've waited for you.
So just empty your suitcase and let's skip that station. Let's hold on to this place. I'm sure they'll understand. Let's not let our hearts break. This won't be a mistake. I've waited my whole life. I've waited for you.
I'll empty this suitcase and we'll skip that station. Let's hold on to this place. I'm sure they'll understand. Let's not let our hearts break. This won't be a mistake. I've waited my whole life. I've waited for you.
As Arya and Dorian approach the driveway of her father's house, Arya can't help but feel a sense of relief. After the strange encounter at the rundown gas station with Oren, she looks forward to the safety and comfort of being in her father's presence again. As they step out of the car onto the polished concrete driveway, they're greeted with a modern luxury home that seems to stretch on forever. Arya still recognizes it as the house she grew up in, but it's clear that her father has made some major renovations since her last visit. The sleek, minimalistic design is a bold departure from the Victorian home she remembers. She approaches it with a nonchalance that seems to come from years of growing up with this kind of lifestyle. Dorian, on the other hand, feels more uncomfortable with each step he takes toward the house. The excessive luxury of the home is a sharp contrast to his own humble upbringing, and he can't help but feel out of place and inadequate. The driveway is like a glossy runway leading up to the glass and steel front door that seems to disappear into the walls of the house. And the landscaping is equally impressive, with perfectly manicured lawns and a series of waterfall features that flow seamlessly into one another like a symphony of nature. It's clear that no expense was spared in the design and construction of this home. It's also clear that Dorian sees it as excessively grandiose. Arya sees that his eyes are wide with discomfort. She knows the house must seem like a palace to someone who grew up in such a small, cramped apartment like the one he currently rents. She can sense his anxiety. She takes his hand and gives it a reassuring squeeze. "Don't worry," she says with a smile. "My dad's not as formal as the house might make him seem. He's actually a really down-to-earth guy." Dorian nods, trying to push away his feelings of inadequacy, and together they make their way up the driveway, ready to meet Arya's father. As they enter the house, an even stronger sense of luxury and opulence is displayed. The spacious foyer is wide with high ceilings and large windows that allow natural light to flood the space like a warm embrace. The floors gleam beneath their feet, made of polished marble, and the walls are painted in neutral tones, giving the space a clean and modern feel. The living room is furnished with designer seating, including sleek, low-profile couches and armchairs upholstered in plush fabrics like soft clouds. Several contemporary art pieces hang on the walls, adding splashes of color and interest to the space. The kitchen is a chef's dream with top-of-the-line appliances and a large island with bar seating. Everything is equipped with the latest smart technology, allowing the control of the thermostats, lighting, and security systems with just a few voice commands. Formal dining room with a long polished ebony table, elegant china, home theater room, office study room, etc. As Arya and Dorian venture further into the house, they hear the sound of pool balls clacking together and the thud of a cue making contact with its target. Following the sound, they come upon a lounge with a pool table at its center, surrounded by walls lined with shelves of books and other treasures. A large LED TV in the room's corner displays the local news channel on mute. Mr. Blanchett stands at the table, his attention focused on the game at hand. He looks up as Arya and Dorian enter the room, a smile spreading across his face as he sees his daughter. "Arya, my dear," he says, setting his cue down. "I'm so glad you could make it." He approaches Arya and gives her a warm embrace, then turns to Dorian and extends a hand. "And you must be Dorian," he says. "I've heard so much about you. It's a pleasure to finally meet you." Dorian shakes Mr. Blanchett's hand, feeling a little nervous, but also grateful for the warm welcome. He can see where Arya gets her elegant form from. "Would you like a drink?" Mr. Blanchett asks, gesturing toward a small bar near the corner of the room. "I have a bottle of Cabernet that I think you'll enjoy. Dinner should be ready in just a little while." Dorian looks to Arya, who nods her approval, and they both accept Mr. Blanchett's offer. He pours them each a glass, and they sit in the lounge to enjoy it while they chat. Arya turns to her father. "I barely recognize the house anymore," she says. "You've made so many modern design changes." Mr. Blanchett nods as he speaks. "After recently selling one of my companies, I decided it was time for an upgrade from the Victorian style. I wanted something more modern and timeless." "I have to say, you've done a fantastic job," Dorian says. "This place is really amazing." Mr. Blanchett smiles at Dorian's compliment. "Thank you. I'm glad you think so." As they continue to chat, Dorian can't help but feel a sense of admiration for Mr. Blanchett. Despite his lavish home, he does seem to value family and relationships above all else, and Dorian is grateful to be included in their family dynamic. Nearing the end of their second glass of wine, everyone feels even more comfortable, perhaps too comfortable. As Dorian glances at the watch on Mr. Blanchett's wrist, he's struck by its unique design and obvious quality. "Nice watch," he says, trying to be polite. Mr. Blanchett grins, slipping the watch off his wrist. "Thanks," he says, handing it over to Dorian. "Go ahead, take a look." Dorian handles the watch carefully, turning it over in his hands. He looks at the open case back and sees the impressively decorated movement, the brand name etched into the gold rotor. Audemars Piguet. "Do you know what that is?" Mr. Blanchett asks, a hint of pride in his voice. Dorian shakes his head, feeling a little out of his depth. "I don't know much about watches," he admits. Mr. Blanchett nods understandingly. "It's a Royal Oak chronograph," he says, "special edition. I bought that one as a little present to myself after I sold the company. Cost me about $100,000. In shock, Dorian's face drains of color at the exorbitant price. He can't believe someone would spend so much money on a single watch. As Mr. Blanchett continues to boast about his expensive purchase, Dorian can't help but feel that the man has lost a bit of his elegance. Maybe the wine is getting to him, he thinks. Arya, sitting beside Dorian, seems to sense its unease. She gives her father a pointed look, her words slurred slightly from the wine they've been drinking. "Dad, it's bad form to be talking about money like that." Mr. Blanchett's smile falters for a moment. He seems to realize the mistake he's made. "Sorry," he says, a little more sheepishly. "I didn't mean to come off as boastful. Must be the wine." Despite Mr. Blanchett's apology, Dorian struggles to lose the feeling of discontentment that's settled in his stomach. He now feels even more out of place in this lavish, luxurious home surrounded by expensive possessions on a level of wealth that he feels he can never attain. Mr. Blanchett clears his throat, trying to steer the conversation in a different direction. "Have you two heard anything about this?" he says, pointing at the TV in the corner. Dorian's eyes widen as he sees a news report on screen showing Saturn, the title under the image, Saturn's Window. "Oh yeah," Arya says, "it's been going around on social media." "Ah, that silly thing has been all over the news lately," Mr. Blanchett says, a hint of superiority in his voice. "Silly?" Dorian asks. Arya turns her head away from the screen to face Dorian. "Well, it seems a bit sensationalized, don't you think?" Mr. Blanchett says, trying to sound diplomatic. "Actually," Dorian says, "I find the subject matter to be quite interesting." Arya now shakes her head slowly with her eyes closed, a touch of embarrassment on her face. Mr. Blanchett raises an eyebrow. "Really? Well, tell me, what do you find so interesting about it?" "I don't know exactly," Dorian says. "There's just something about what Kurchart, the guy who discovered the anomaly, has been saying about it. It makes me feel compelled to pay attention." "Well, I suppose it's natural to be curious about these things," Mr. Blanchett says, trying to sound understanding. "But I must say, I'm a bit less gullible." "Dad, please," Arya says, hoping to avoid an argument. No, it's all right, dear," Mr. Blanchett says. "It's important to be critical of these things." He turns back to Dorian. "Have you considered the possibility that this could all just be a social psychological experiment?" Dorian shakes his head. "I'm not sure what you mean." Mr. Blanchett smiles lightly. "Well, think about it. Y2K, everyone goes into a panic and nothing happens. 2012, everyone fears for their lives and nothing happens. Saturn's Window. All of your friends on social media are in a frenzy. What makes you think this is any different?" Arya laughs. "Dad, I didn't say anyone was in a frenzy." "Well, you get my point," Mr. Blanchett says apologetically. "I just think it's important to be wary of these things. There are always people in power who want to see how the public will react to unexpected threats. They stage these scenarios and we fall for it every time, so don't be surprised if they announce we're being invaded by aliens next." Arya laughs. Mr. Blanchett continues, "And besides, if these people had any real understanding of astronomy, they'd know it's impossible for Saturn of all planets to pose a threat to Earth. That planet is far out in deep space. The entire idea is preposterous." Dorian chimes in after being respectively patient. "Well, that's actually part of why it's so fascinating. Kurchart never said it was a threat at all. He just said that we'd have a unique window of opportunity to see Saturn in our skies like no one has ever seen it before. It's apparently just a rare solar alignment that happens once every several million years. Somehow the path of light from the planets will bend to project the image of Saturn against our atmosphere, like a big movie projector. An optical illusion." Mr. Blanchett's head tilts to the side a bit as his brow furrows. He's taken off guard by Dorian's detailed explanation as he ponders the idea for a moment. "Well," he says, "I can see how that could be intriguing from a scientific perspective." "Have you studied science at all, Dorian?" Dorian shakes his head. "No, not at all. I just find it interesting." Feeling embarrassed by where the conversation is going, Arya attempts to change the subject. So Dad, have you given any thought to what we're doing for the holidays this year?" Mr. Blanchett clears his throat and straightens his posture, shifting back into his usual confident demeanor. "Yes, actually, I have. But, Dorian, let me just say that while the idea of this celestial phenomenon may be tantalizing, it's important to remember that there are much more pressing matters to focus on in life. You might want to pay attention to the stock market, for example. If you do that," he says, "you might find a window of opportunity that'll actually make a difference in your life." He continues to make his way toward the bar. "How about another glass?" A maid carefully shows up and apologetically interrupts, her hands clasped in front of her. "Sorry to disturb Mr. Blanchett, but dinner is ready whenever you are." Her eyes flicker to Arya and Dorian as she speaks, some shyness in her demeanor. "I hope you don't mind, but I took the liberty of setting the table for three." Mr. Blanchett nods, a slight frown crossing his face as he glances at the clock. "Thank you, Maria. We'll be there in just a few minutes." The maid nods, casting a quick apologetic smile toward Arya and Dorian before disappearing back the way she came. Mr. Blanchett turns back to Dorian, a hint of regret in his eyes. "I hope you don't mind the interruption. Maria is an excellent cook, and I hate to keep her waiting." Arya smiles, shaking her head. "Of course not, Dad. We're literally starving. Let's go eat."
"Dear love, hold tight. I'll be coming home real soon to undo distance from me to you. I won't disappear, so don't shed a tear for me. For me. Ease up for now, I'll be on my way home for you. All through the night, I'll patiently plan this move. No need to fear, soon you'll be near to me, to me. For now we'll imagine time holding the space between us, moments away.
Coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. Today, the many talents of Quanah J. Hicks. He can be found on Instagram at Poems of Yore, Y-O-R-E. We started the show with Quanah reading Fringford Brook by Violet Jacob. Then the interview. Then Because I Could Not Stop for Death by Emily Dickinson. Then Ozymandias by Percy Shelley. Then Quanah's piece As Further Gets Closer. Then Quanah reading Children of Light by Robert Lowell. And The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe. Then a tune by Quanah, All My Life, featuring Angie Hart. Then Quanah reading a chapter from his book Saturn's Window. This book is available on Amazon and the audiobook is coming soon. And we just wrap things up with Quanah's tune, Dear Love. Once again, Quanah J. Hicks can be found on Instagram at Poems of Yore. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.